Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Salem, the podcast.
We are your hosts and favorite Salem tour guides.
My name is Sarah Black.
And I'm Jeffrey Lilly.
And today we have a very special guest, a very fun collaboration on the docket. Please welcome L.A. Beatles, creator and host of Unsinkable, the Titanic podcast. Today we are talking about the Titanic. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. As I was listening to you do your intro, I'm sort of fangirling because the intro is in my ears so often when I'm cleaning my kitchen or I'm running on the treadmill. And every time one of your episodes starts, I get the little,
a little dance.
When a new episode of one of your favorite podcast posts, you're excited. So I get to see that in person. It sort of blows my mind, but I'm very excited to be here. I am a historian, history nerd. Salem has been something I've read about on and off for years. That's why I obviously found your podcast. This is a dream come true for me. So thanks for having me.
Well, absolutely. We are very excited to, figure out why on earth we're all sitting down together.
Well, that's true. We do have a reveal. There's a reason that we have collaborated, not just because we're both podcasts.
Yes. Absolutely. We know why we're sitting down. The listeners are probably very confused right now.
Yeah. Turning in, they'll be like, wait, Salem? Wait, Titanic? What am I listening to?
Yeah. We just want to keep people guessing as much as we possibly can.
It's the Salem Harbor, right? We have oh, is maritime that, history.
Oh, the Titanic sank in Salem Harbor. Is that what it was?
It was trying to get into the tunnels.
That'll be the new conspiracy making the rounds on the Titanic TikTok. I feel like every 3 months there's a new weird conspiracy that has no grounding in reality. So that could be the new one.
I'm so excited to hear more about, what brought you to this podcast, because I guess I didn't realize how into the Titanic people still are.
Oh, my God.
Go ahead.
My roommate's one of them. She's a little bit of a huge Titanic, but distinctly a little bit.
They have a whole cabinet in their living room dedicated to Titanic memorabilia. So I don't think that's very common.
I don't know. Yeah, she's got some White Star memorabilia. She's got, I don't think it's a replica of the polar bear, and a little piece.
Oh, that's pretty deep.
Yeah,
that's deep. That's not casual.
No,
and a little piece of the Titanic. as well.
Oh, the piece of coal or a bigger piece?
No, not coal, wood, off a cabinet or something.
Oh, okay. This is your roommate is a very deep Titaniac. This is like a big.
Did you just say Titaniac?
That's what we refer to ourselves as. Although I don't love it. It's just sort of become accepted in the community. And some people would say it maybe has a negative connotation, but I don't think it does, because I have seen many Titaniacs refer to themselves as that. But yeah, that's kind of the word now, I think.
That's great. Yeah. Titaniac. You got to go home and tell her she's a Titaniac.
Well, she also doesn't know that I'm recording this.
Oh, she's going to geek out, I think.
Earlier today, she's like, oh, what episode are you recording? And I was like, I'm not telling you. And she's like, what? And I was
secret.
It's a niche interest of yours. And she's like, it's Salem, it's architecture, it's tea, it's antiques. And I'm like, nope. And she did not guess, and I did not tell her.
I did do an episode on Polar the Titanic Bear, so there is a whole episode on that. And it's actually a pretty devastating story, weirdly. You'd think something connected to a stuffed bear wouldn't be, not to get off topic. But yeah, you should tell her there's an episode about the bear.
Okay. I will let her know. But yes, so passively familiar with Titaniacs.
Yeah, I think most of our listeners probably have some general understanding or awareness of the Titanic, the British ocean liner that sank during its maiden voyage on April 15th, 1912. And
that's the day we're recording this.
That's so crazy. I didn't realize it until we spoke early this morning. And I looked at the date and I said, oh my gosh, we just happened to be doing it on the anniversary.
Well, this is how my life has just been since I started doing. And I guess you asked me a question and I didn't answer it. But really, did you want me to go ahead and say sort of the origin of the podcast?
Sure.
Or should I?
Sure.
So I'll keep it brief. And, you know, if people want like a deeper dive, pardon the pun, I use probably deeper dive too much to be a historian of something like this. But if they want that, you know, I have episodes about sort of my journey with it and that kind of thing. But backstory, I was 13 when the movie came out in 97. So I was the world's biggest Leo head, Kate Winslet fan, you know, watched all of James Cameron's movies, fell in love with movies, I think, more because of this movie. I was just obsessed. I saw it 13 times in the theaters.
Oh my gosh.
I was one of those girls. Yeah. And so I just fell in love with the story of the ship as well as a teenager. Was super into it, which is pretty common. And then over the next, you know, 15 years or so, it would just sort of ebb and flow, and I would watch the movie or I would start reading about it again. And then in the early pandemic, I think it probably was a form of therapy, but I was rewatching the movie one night and reminded of how much I loved it, hadn't seen it in a while, sort of sitting on the couch crying. We're all going through this horrible time. My kids were so small at the time, we were so stressed. And so I think as a form of therapy, I just ordered books. I said to myself, let me get back into reading about it. It'll be a nice hobby. We have nothing but time. And so I did. And I read and I read and I read. And I'm a trained historian. So for me, when I do that, I take copious notes and I sort of employ my skill set as an academic. And then I realized that there was no podcast that really looked at the cultural history of the ship or really did episodes on the history of the ship at all. There were all of these one-off episodes on movie podcasts or history podcasts, and there was no real definitive podcast. And so I just went for it, and I started it from my son's closet, and I thought if I do 5 or 10 episodes and people listen and it's sort of like a set of essays, then that'll be fun. It'll be a pandemic project. I'll move on with my life probably. But it took on a life of its own, and people started listening from all over the world. And now I've traveled all over the world with it and done live shows, and you know, I've over 100 episodes, and I've made some amazing friends doing this, and it's turned into basically a lot of work, but I mean that in a good way. And you guys know how that goes.
Yeah, it's a labor of love.
Yeah. And, you know, when the pandemic started, I was sort of at this point in my career, you know, I have a PhD. I used to teach. I was in public history for a while. A lot of writing, a lot of research over many topics. And I don't know, it's so crazy that this is where I sort of re-entered academia doing this, but it's been fun to do public-facing history and kind of jump into the pool, so to speak, in a completely different way than I ever imagined. It's really rewarding. So yeah, so here I am. It's been a wild ride. It's really fun.
I'm very surprised still that there was no Titanic podcast to begin with, which I think both of us came across the same thing with the Salem idea. There was no podcast solely dedicated to the city. So why not fill the void?
Especially knowing that so many people talk about this subject already and so many people have podcasts. How are we the firsts, I guess?
It was the same. And, you know, there were a couple of good podcasts about the film. There's a great one called Titanic Scene by Scene that I've been on, just fantastic podcast about the movie. So there's a couple of those. But yeah, you know, I saw on Apple Podcasts where people had sort of started one at some point and there were only 3 episodes, or, you know, yeah, I was shocked. I was shocked that no one had really entered that space and done it. And you guys know how it is when you do and you become the people that did do that, then suddenly you're the people that everybody's emailing and everybody, you know, and it becomes this thing, and it's so incredibly rewarding. But yeah, I never thought I'd be Titanic girl. I don't, you know, it's not, I didn't fully see this this future for myself. But at this point, it's completely out of my control, it feels like.
That's so cool. And you've created a space for other people that like to geek out on the Titanic to come together and make those connections. I'm sure you've met a lot of like-minded people along the way and been able to bring those people together with each other as well.
That's really the main thing. And I'm sure you guys feel the same when you meet listeners. You know, I just got to meet some listeners that I did a live show this weekend, and that's the best part. I mean, you know, the Titanic's history is really dark, just as the history of what you guys study is often really dark. But weirdly, it's this bonding experience for people. I always say you could put 10 people that don't know each other in a room, but if they all like Titanic, if you go back in that room an hour later, they'll be planning vacations together. I mean, I've seen it happen, and it's happened to me. And so it is this, I think it's the, you know, the beauty and the tragic nature of it. And it's an obsession that people just kind of never let go. Also, pardon the pun, I guess, movie pun.
All the, but, I have.
Yeah.
So many puns.
But yeah, I was talking to, you know, as one listener I was talking to this weekend, because I had a little Patreon happy hour like after the show. And she had driven 8 hours from Mississippi to come to the show, she and her husband, and just was the most, I mean, I was just crying thinking about it, but we were both crying because she was saying that, you know, the podcast has been special to her, makes her feel seen. And I just was astounded that I could play that part in someone's life and meet someone that I never would have met otherwise. And see, I'm already crying again, but really that's the best part of it. That's the reason to do it. And yeah, I've had a really amazing experience. I'm really grateful.
Making those connections. And I also love the fact that these podcasts prompt us to keep doing the research. Like, I can only imagine all the little intricate details that you've come across and like the aha moments. Do you have any particular like, oh my God, moments that happened during your research?
Yeah. One that comes to mind that is sort of pop culture fun is I was in August of 2022, I was in Ireland for an extended period with my family, and I was doing some research, and we were also kind of turning it into a vacation. And we were in Cove, which was known as Queenstown then, but it was the last port of call for Titanic. And, you know, I just was in dreamland to be there. And there's a Titanic museum, and that was amazing. But there's also a heritage center where they basically have exhibits on, you know, 300 years of naval history and immigration from Ireland. And this one port in Cove, what's now Cove, I mean, if you have Irish ancestry, your ancestors probably went through this port. I mean, that's how much history there is. But I was going through their Titanic exhibit, and they had a message in a bottle. And apparently there's a passenger that did not survive that was from the area, County Cork. And a few days after Titanic sank, this bottle washed up on shore. And it's a message from him. Some of it was worn away by seawater. And you can't really tell whether it was April 12th or April 15th, the date. So it's unclear whether it was during the sinking or prior to the sinking that he let this bottle go. Wow. But his family's pretty sure it's authentic because his mother sent him off with a bottle of holy water. And it was that bottle that the message was in. And so, you know, and I had never heard this story before. I mean, years at this point, already doing the podcast for 2 years and years of reading about Titanic and calling myself, you know, such a well-accomplished historian of all of this. No idea. I was just standing there, you know, what?
That's so
I had
wild.
Heard tale, you know, like I had had a couple of listeners over the first couple of years of the podcast. Oh, did you hear about the message in the box? I don't know. I never followed up. I never looked into it. I just was floored that sort of artifact exists, and it's just sitting in this heritage museum.
And you were just
in Ireland.
Standing
and so,
right
yeah,
in front
I've had
of
a
it.
Lot of really, yeah, a lot of really amazing moments like that. You know, I'm trying to think another research wise, like you were saying, you know, constantly going back to the sources. I'll go back to like the U.S. Senate inquiry testimonies, which is this, you know, 500 pages of all of the crew and passengers that they interviewed right after the sinking, kind of being grilled by this Senator Smith. And if you read the testimony, you can get to know people's personalities. Like Officer Harold Lowe, he's in the 97 movie. I never thought anything about him. I've seen pictures. I've listed out facts about him. Went back and read his testimony, and he was like funny as all get out. Mm-hmm. Like he was sarcastic. He was like fighting back to the senator. You know, the senator asks, "What is an iceberg?" He's like, "What is an iceberg? Do you not know what an iceberg is?" Basically, so you know, it's yeah. The research is. That's the part I really love. That's obviously, you know, my skill set and what I've done for many years. And just as I'm sure you guys find, if you get back into the original sources, there's so many nuggets of mm-hmm. wisdom and oftentimes overlooked. And so you can never trust the secondary material to do that for you. Like you have to go back to the original sources in order to feel good about your own interpretation, obviously. And that I'm constantly reminded of that.
It's got to be fascinating to have such a wealth of information because we have, I mean, in comparison, we have nothing, you know, to the amount of resources that you have for your subject matter. We have a handful of documents and pages.
Well, yeah, it's 1600s versus 1912.
Yeah, I can only imagine, like,
yeah,
some of that existed and has been lost. Can you imagine, like, if you could go through that and, like, listen to these other people's, like, actual, you know, all the people whose voices are lost, all the pieces, people who, like, went to trial and we just don't even have records of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, what they were thinking in their off-time interviews. They weren't conducting, not person-to-person, no. Mm-hmm. Very few letters, no messages in a bottle. That's so cool.
Imagine it would be like you guys having, you know, day by day diaries of some of the victims of the witch trials or something like that. I mean, you guys do an amazing job with the source material that you do have. But yeah, 1600s, that's rough. That's tough. Like research in that period is just from the little bit I did in grad school and such. It's hard work. I know.
I think we both have a very similar approach, though, that when we do the research, we're looking for the individual stories and like the baseline people. Like we just want to get on the ground and get as close to these individuals as possible. Even though it may be 1600s versus 1900s, they're still people. And I feel like by the end of the episodes, you do have a pretty good sense of who these folks are. So like hearing you talk about reading, you know, his humor in the testimony, like I love being able to go back to the source material and get just a little bit closer to these names that we've been hearing about for so long. Mm-hmm. And I think with the Titanic, it's really interesting because I think we look at it as just a big... like a big tragedy, big ship, big tragedy, like went down, so many lives lost. It would take someone so much effort and time to like go in and look at those individual stories, which is probably why people love your podcast so much because you are doing that work. And then they get to learn more about these humans and their experiences through the tragedy. So it just makes the whole thing come more to life, I guess.
I agree. And I think it's why I like your podcast as well. You know, I love all your episodes, but I get most excited when I pull it up and I see that it's one of the witch trial victims or it's, you know, a person. I love just from beginning to end unpacking a human being story. And I'm not super interested in all of the times they succeeded. I'm way more interested in, you know, the weird stuff and the failures and the, you know, and the trauma and how they got through trauma because we all have trauma. But yeah, I mean, those are my favorite episodes of your podcast. And by far, you know, if I go back and I look at my download numbers or if I look at what feedback I've gotten or I look through my emails from people, it's always the episodes about the individual passengers that are, I think, the most compelling and people respond to the most. And not that the other episodes aren't important, but yeah, I think that's why people are listening. I think everybody wants to know, at least, you know, Titanic people, if I could do an episode on every single person that was on the ship, they would love that. I never could. That's way too much. And we don't have the info on everybody.
It's only like 2000 passengers.
Yeah, just, you know, just I'll be doing this until I'm 87. No big deal.
I had a question. So you probably don't deal in rumors to the level that rumors and misinformation. Just as our topic has been digested over, you know, 330 odd years. And when some of the historians have looked into it, whether they were biased, whether they were lacking information, that changed the narrative almost completely within the scope of the witch trials. Do you have like a big rumor to dispel or anything that like the movie got like glaring, like if everyone thinks one thing and it's actually another, or
there's a lot. Yeah. And I was just thinking like you guys are very in tune with that thematically. You know, with the movie, I would say the biggest thing is Molly Brown, because she definitely was not Molly Brown. She definitely was not like a big Western sounding, like, you know, we lit the money on fire in the stove. She wasn't like that at all. She was actually like really into fitness and very svelte and very sophisticated. You could like look at pictures of her, and it's not even just about the physical appearance, that doesn't matter, but she was part of society. Like, she wasn't some outsider hated person like mm-hmm. the movie portrays. She was like a month before Titanic, she was with J.J. Astor and his new wife in Egypt at like resorts hanging out. So, okay. Yeah. So she's not as much of an outsider to society as the film would lead you to believe. And that's all mythology that was created about her after she died. And there's the musical Unsinkable Molly Brown. And supposedly she was, you know, as a baby, was put in some sort of like a wicker basket and put down a river or something. I don't know. That none of that is true. None of that is true. But yeah, there's a ton of conspiracy theories. I was just on a panel Saturday as part of the anniversary weekend. One of the historians that was there did a really great job of dispelling this fire myth. So a couple of years ago, the internet went wild because there was this new news that there had been a fire in one of the coal bunkers on Titanic. And of course, that must have made the steel really weak. And of course, that must be why the ship sank, right? And we finally figured it out. But anybody who's ever studied Titanic knows that the coal fire was known. It was known in 1912. It's been known by historians the whole time. It was very common for fires to be going in these bunkers, and they would just sort of slowly be put out. And that was sort of part of the process. So, you know, it's things like that. It ebbs and flows, but I'll get messages from people whenever like a new theory hits the internet. But most of them are very easily, you know, dismissed. I mean, there's one that like Titanic and Olympic, its sister ship, were switched, and actually the Olympic sank. And it's
because of the is that because of the smokestacks? No, is that something?
No, because of it was supposed to be like an insurance scam from J.P. Morgan. That's the conspiracy theory, that like he needed to sink a ship for insurance reasons, and he switched them. It's horrible. Like it's terrible. It makes no sense, and it's so easily dismissible. But you know, people love a good conspiracy, and I'm sure you guys get this all the time too. Like, People love mystery. You know, I'm obsessed with the story of the lost colony of Roanoke. That's another one of mine. It's like,
yeah, that's a good
Titanic,
one.
Salem, lost colony of Roanoke. That's like my three big ones. And that's another one where the actual explanations are a lot simpler and more about historiography and more about, you know, the history of Native Americans in that one, for example. But people want the fun, crazy conspiracy parts more than anything.
Yeah, it's like trying to use ergot poisoning.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, I should have thought of that. I feel like that's probably one of yours that's akin to these conspiracy theories that I get. It's so frustrating to hear it like over and over again when it's been.
It pops up every time. Someone's like, oh, what about ergot? And you're like, can we just not?
It would be easy. I get, like you're saying, people love mystery. I think people love trying to solve the mystery even more. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the answer is really just the simplest answer. They hit the iceberg. It was too much for the ship. Like, I know it's probably more complicated than that.
No, actually, you're 100% right. I mean, it's
like, is that it?
No, it is. It's,
you know, look at that.
I mean, some people will tell you, oh, it was the perfect storm of, you know, 20 things. And it was. But really, the simplest answer is the correct one. It maybe Captain Smith shouldn't have been in an ice field. Maybe they should have stopped for the night. I mean, I'm not in the business of blaming Captain Smith. That's a whole thing. I'll get in trouble if I do that. I don't want to anger the Titaniacs. But yeah, but I mean, it hit an iceberg and it hit it in such a way, like .. across the ship, that too much water got in and it's a floating object. And so it sank. And, you know, the crazy thing I always tell people that don't know much about it too, is that the reason so many people lived is because it sank really slowly. Like, it could have gone down a lot faster and everybody would have died. But because of the technology on the ship and because of the heroism truly of the crew, you know, a lot of people did survive. I wish it was everybody, but really the technology on the ship is what kept it afloat for, you know, 2 hours and 40 minutes, which is pretty astounding. I mean, the Lusitania went down in 17 minutes, and that was just a few years later. So,
oh, I'm having flashbacks to the movie. I was also, I was a little younger than 13 at when it came out in the 90s. I wasn't allowed to watch certain scenes as in my age.
I'm just a hair older than you, and we went as a school field trip.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I think I probably saw it 4 or 5 times, but I think it was sophomore year, if I could be wrong, but we were doing like a hero trope in English. That was like, we were studying the hero character.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the teachers convinced the school to let us go see it.
Who was the hero, so that, Jack?
Yeah,
no, it's Rose. It's Rose. We have to go. I really think this is my thing about James Cameron too. I like a lot of his films, not all, but most of them. He always puts this like badass female character, you know, at the top of his films. They're always like the headliner, I feel. So I don't know. I think, yeah, maybe mm-hmm. it's Rose, which would be awesome if that's what your teacher was thinking, I hope. But maybe they just wanted to go see Titanic.
I think it was Jack.
Oh, okay. Jack's also a hero. Jack's definitely a hero too. And then Cal is like the best movie villain ever. He's totally channeling like the villains of like 1940s Hollywood in that role. It's just like the classic villain, which I love.
I love that actor so much.
I think there's a good few stars in that movie to pick a favorite from.
But yeah, speaking of survivors mm-hmm. and talking about those stories, I think we should, I'm going to say this again, dive into, pun, dive into this specific story that brought our two podcasts together. And I am going to give them, I'm going to let everyone know at the start why exactly this happened, so there is no confusion.
I mean, we're still a little confused.
I mean,
I think we used, but sure. Yeah.
So today we're talking about two passengers in particular, Elizabeth and her daughter, Mary Lines. This collaboration came about because, A, we have some listeners that listen to both podcasts, so they were really pushing for this. Mm-hmm. So thank you guys for introducing us.
You need to...
Yeah. We'll give the people what they want, right? But then you and I had started communicating. LA had reached out and was totally on board with the idea and mentioned that we just happened to have a survivor buried in Salem, Elizabeth Lines. And not just in any cemetery... My favorite cemetery, Harmony Grove Cemetery. So when I heard this, I just about freaked out.
Like to have a Mayflower passenger and a Titanic passenger.
Oh, yeah.
It's just so cool.
Yeah, that's wild.
Ah, that's funny. I didn't even think about that. But as we later discovered, she is actually buried in Pine Grove Cemetery mm-hmm. in the neighboring town of Topsfield. But even now, if you guys went and looked her up, you would see Harmony Grove, Salem, Massachusetts.
Everybody says Harmony Grove. I went through some of my books, even some published academic books by people that I respect. It says that. Yeah. So I think there's been some major confusion. Yeah.
And I think I have an explanation for some of the confusion, but we can save that more towards the end when we talk about her death. But yeah, Topsfield, in our defense, you know, once we discovered this, I said, let's do the podcast episode anyways, because A, this is a really cool topic, and B, Topsfield isn't that far away. And we actually have some cool Salem Witch Trials connections with Topsfield.
Yeah.
Okay. Rebecca Nurse and her family, the town family, came from Topsfield. So,
oh, and I've been to the Rebecca Nurse homestead. I have been there years and years ago. I spent a good little block of time in Salem when I was in grad school, and that was one of the places I went. It was amazing.
Well, there you go.
Full circle.
So that's Danvers, which was Salem, part of the greater concept of Salem.
Yeah.
But they were from
Topsfield.
But they were originally from Topsfield. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, when Sarah said this to me, and she's like, hey, we're doing this episode, the name, and I was like, okay, cool. And then I just started doing like some casual reading, and I was like, wait, I thought I didn't just like message her. I was like, well, we'll chat about this later. And was it yesterday?
Yeah.
Like we had like that non-conversation of like, wait, hold on. She's like, don't say anything. I was like, don't say anything. She's like, don't say anything. I was like, we're both talking about not talking about the same thing. She's like, yeah. And then we're like, okay, we're going to save it for right now.
I love it. Yeah. So, I rely on you for all of the geography you know, I have been to Boston and I have been to Salem and Marblehead and apparently Danvers, but I don't understand where anything is because obviously I'm not from there or have ever lived there. But I do have a very dear friend that grew up in Salem. So, when we were roommates in grad school, there was a window of time where we didn't have our keys to our house yet, and we were homeless. And so we went up to his parents' house in Salem and just invaded for like 2 weeks because we had nowhere else to go. And so I got
that's a great spot to go.
Yeah, this glorious 2 weeks in Salem. So it was a great trip. I love it. I love Salem. I want to bring my kids up there so badly.
And you were probably looking forward to going to Harmony Grove and seeing this woman's gravesite.
I wasn't, you know, I was probably more concerned about where I was going to get a whiskey sour at that point in my life. But I was like 24. It is amazing how much bad information there is. You go to Encyclopedia Titanica, which is a great site, and it's, you know, considered a very great resource on all the passengers and crew, but it says Harmony Grove.
Right. So Mary and Elizabeth, the two women that we're talking about, Mary was 16 when she boarded the Titanic in 1912, and her mother was 50?
50, is that right? I believe. Yeah, she was right at 50.
Elizabeth's husband and Mary's father, Dr. Ernest Howard Lines, was a New York native. He was the president and medical director of the New York Life Insurance Company. So from what I could tell, they were pretty well off. I even saw them described as like old money.
Yeah, from what I could tell, they were very well off. And she, when living in Topsfield, had what seemed to be described as like very significant amount of money.
Yes, and I did see a reference to Mary later in life. I think the quote was like palatial home. I think they had very nice homes in the area. Most of what we have for passengers like this prior to Titanic, it's census records, and it takes a lot of digging because the moment they're on Titanic is when they sort of become famous in a way, or, you know, in newspapers in a new way, and you can search. But the best that I can tell, they were really moneyed from kind of both sides, and they were living in Paris pretty full time, I believe. The brother Howard, who was a few years older than Mary, he was the older son. He was graduating from Dartmouth, and so they were coming back to go to his graduation. But I believe they spent most of their time in Paris at that stage in their lives as a family. But the dad was not on Titanic, we should mention. So he was not
right.
And if he had been, obviously, there would have been a very high likelihood that he wouldn't have made it, but he was not. He was back in the United States.
So I'd seen that, and I saw in a couple of things that some people were saying that he was toying with the idea of going or not going, and then a business meeting called him away, and which at the end of the day, saved his life.
Yeah, and there's so many instances like that with Titanic. There's an entire book that someone wrote in the 90s called Psychic Forewarnings of a Tragedy, and it's all about Titanic. Ooh. And all of the, like, just missed it, or someone had a bad feeling, or someone had a dream, or a lot of situations like that where just, like, a last minute or, you know, random little detail kept them off the ship. There's, like, hundreds and hundreds of them.
That's interesting.
But he did make it to his son's graduation.
As did they all.
Yeah.
Yes, I believe so.
Coming from this tier of society, they were able to afford first class tickets. I saw that the cost of those tickets was about £39 and change, which would have been $14,000 or so in today's money. But that was a joint ticket for both Elizabeth and Mary. So it might have been, I think it might have been $7,000 a piece or so, which is pretty good.
I mean, that's actually
not bad.
How long?
First class.
How long was the journey supposed to be?
Almost a week. So, you know, it
and $1,000 a day.
And the first class accommodations. I mean, this is the thing about Titanic that was so huge at the time, is that all of these steamships had been competing for business. Who was going to be the most luxurious? You know, there was Cunard, there was the Hamburg America line in Germany, and this was the race to make first class on these ships basically like a five-star hotel. And so that is what Titanic was touted as for the first class. Now, in third class, it was an immigrant ship, and that's obviously a whole nother story and a huge part of Titanic's story. But yeah, I mean, it was traveling in full luxury. There were multiple restaurants on board and salons. There was a pool. There were squash courts. There was a gym. Everything was supposed to be the utmost. There were heaters. There was running water in the rooms. And so, I mean, there were some like B-deck suites, like the ones that, I mean, like Rose and her mom would have been in the movie, that were the equivalent of like $100,000 now. So, yeah.
My gosh.
So all of that's included, all the restaurants, all the meals, all the. So for $1,000 a day.
Not bad.
That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I don't think it's that dissimilar than from what people would pay now to go on like a Cunard, because Cunard still runs. And it's funny, they bought White Star Line at one point, and they run these ads for Cunard that are like, come sail with White Star service. It blows my mind. They're still pulling, you know, from this vocabulary. But yeah, so that their tickets would have been on kind of the lower to mid sort of tier of first class, which doesn't mean they were obviously very well off, but they weren't in one of the, you know, luxurious suites that had the, you know, open veranda with the ocean view. There were lots of different tiers in first class ticket wise.
Well, I guess the class lines kind of fade away on that fateful night when the ship went down. Although I think their class probably helped them get to a lifeboat pretty quickly. Would have helped them kind of jump to the front of the line a bit?
In general, yes. The first class passengers had much easier access to the boats. This is a, you know, oft debated topic. Third class passengers were... A lot of them were told to stay below, waiting instructions. A lot of them didn't speak English, which really hurt their chances because there was no signage in other languages and the crew were not versed in other languages. So there were just a confluence of forces that, yeah, I mean, if you were in third class, you were in a bad state geographically in the ship. You were a bad state, you know, culturally. Third class was looked upon as steerage. And so first class, like the moment in the movie when Ruth says, oh, I hope the boats are organized according to class. That's probably something a lot of people would have said that night because of how the class structure was in society at the time. It was very... very marked. And so, yes, first class women, the survival rate is really, really high. With them specifically, I was going back through the research I had on them. They stayed in their cabin for a while, though. It was a little different than a lot of first class stories I've seen. They said that they were told to stay put. They really weren't aware of how dire the situation was, which was pretty common that night, unfortunately. And then a man named Percival White, I believe was his name, came. He was another first class passenger who sadly died, but he noticed that their cabin light was still on and said, you know, knocked and said, "You guys really need to go up to the boat deck. It's things are getting dire up here."
So I had to interrupt for a question.
Yeah, please.
I saw that they sat in their cabin. I guess when the crew said, "It's fine, everything's going to be okay. Just hang out in your cabin." Did people not feel the iceberg? Was there like?
I don't think they would know what's happening.
No, it was a very subtle sound, depending on where you were in the ship.
Okay, so it wasn't like a...
And you're on the unsinkable ship. Like, I'm sure the last thing on their mind was, like, the ship's going to go down.
But if you get into, like, even, like, a minor car accident, you know, there's a... And I don't know, maybe just the size of things predetermines that. But I found it strange that they were just like, oh, we'll just wait. It's like, if there's... It wasn't a big crash.
It wasn't, you know, in the part of the ship that... you know, the single men were in. And again, I hate to reference the movie so much, but I feel like it's such a common cultural touchstone that, you know, people can use that as a reference if they've seen the film. But like where Jack and Fabrizio would have been, like with the single men down in that part of the ship, way below, they felt it. And that water was streaming in, just like they show in the movie. And so they would have been like, what the hell is going on pretty quickly. But for a lot of the first class passengers, they were up near the top of the ship. And a lot of them, if you go back through like letters and testimonies and things, most of them describe it as either like a rolling marble. Like it felt like how it feels when like a marble falls across the floor or an object kind of slides across the floor.
Oh,
yeah.
That's eerie.
Yeah. Or like a gentle rumbling. Most people were kind of awakened by the fact that the ship stopped more than they were by the sound of the iceberg. So yeah, first class, I mean, the movie's right. I mean, they were serving brandy, they were hanging out, the band was playing. I mean, that is real because in first class, the stewards didn't want to alarm anybody. And many first class passengers just never imagined that they would be in a scenario where they would need to get in a lifeboat with a, you know, a Syrian third class passenger. Like to them, that would have been as wild a concept of like me going and running naked on my street right now. You know what I mean? Like it's wow. Like it was the way that society was arranged. They would not have fathomed that could be their life that night at all until it happens. And suddenly they're like the Lyonses, they're in one of these lifeboats with people from all classes.
So they were, like we said, two of the lucky ones, Mary and Elizabeth. After they were alerted to the urgency of the situation, they grabbed their life belts, headed up to the top. And this, I was surprised. I read that the officer secured their vests and said, "We are sending you out as a matter of precaution. We hope you will be back for breakfast." Mm-hmm. So like no one really knew. I mean, maybe he did know and he's just trying to like keep calm, or maybe they didn't really think that it was going to go down.
I think,
but I guess, sorry, I saw their lifeboat was half full, so I would, given that information, I would, they probably didn't know. If you knew and were trying to keep people calm, you would have tried to fill it. I agree.
I think, you know, it's kind of mixed reports that night on the stewards, you know, and crew members. Like some of them, I think, understood how dire it was. There are reports and testimony that some of the crew members didn't realize the ship was really going down until, you know, the water's almost all the way up the stern. I think you're right. I think for that boat specifically, I think they were in lifeboat 9. Let me look. Yeah, lifeboat 9. I think there were 30 something people in their boat, and the boats that went out half full, they were having trouble finding people to go in them because so many people thought it incomprehensible that the ship would actually be sinking. So it was either go out in one of these lifeboats in the cold, cold night and feel the elements, feel like you're just in the middle of nowhere in this tiny little boat, or stay on this huge ship that you've been told is unsinkable and there's brandy being poured and there's like hot food coming out and the kitchens are still working and the lights are still working and the heaters are still working. Yeah. So a lot of the boats went out half full. I was looking at the roster of their lifeboat just to sort of familiarize myself. There were a ton of like super famous passengers in their boat, but it seemed like a good mix of like men and women and different classes. I saw some second class passengers that I recognized in there. But yeah, and from what I read, they had trouble getting that boat down. And so I can't remember if it was Elizabeth or Mary remembered that they felt as the boat was just above the water, I think there was a very awkward moment where it felt like it was tipping. And that happened with several of the boats because everything was happening so fast. And they had had no boat drills. So
Why would you?
Right? Why in the world? You know, they had designed these new davit systems and these, you know, this is a brand new ship. Yeah, why run muster drills? Or why, you know, skill your crew on how to lower these boats? It just doesn't make any sense, right? It blows the mind.
They thought it was just as unsinkable.
Mm-hmm. They absolutely did. That is not a myth. I think every single person that walked on that ship probably did, you know, at their core, think that.
So being that they were some of the first to go out on a lifeboat, one thing that struck me was reading that Mary, by the time that the ship went down, they were far enough away that they could not hear the people struggling and screaming in the water. And if you've seen the movie, that is just such an image. Like that part of the movie is, that movie in general is pretty hard to watch. It's so well done. I enjoy it. Still watch it to this day, but it is, that part's rough when you see all those people struggling. So I can't imagine being actually there in a boat knowing that so many people have been left behind. And then also, they're just in the boat paddling away, hoping that someone comes and picks them up. Like, your fate isn't necessarily guaranteed at that point. You got to hope that, and they were like half dressed too, so they probably would have been freezing on top of it. So yeah, it's no wonder that Mary didn't really talk about it very much. It doesn't seem like her or Elizabeth talked about it very much until later on in life, because it would have been traumatic to relive.
Yeah, and you hear this a lot with actually one thing I've read a lot of is that children of survivors, and of course Mary is a child of a survivor, but also a survivor, so that's a unique case. But I have read many accounts where children born to parents after they survived Titanic didn't find out that their parent was on Titanic till they were, you know, 15 years old, 18 years old. And I think that, you know, it's a trauma response, but it was very common among survivors to not want to speak about the tragedy at all, there are some families where it wasn't even revealed until after the person died and maybe like a grandchild found out. And everything I read about Elizabeth particularly is that she did not want to speak about it after it happened. And Mary, I think, from what I could gather, spoke about it maybe a little bit more after her mother passed away. But I don't think it was like dinner table conversation in their family. It doesn't seem like it.
I don't think I'd be surprised if it was for anyone's family, to be honest. That is an experience for sure.
You got to remember, we're looking at, you know, early 1900s. Mental health wasn't really, you know,
That's true.
World War II's just after that, and we're like, oh, shell shock. Mm-hmm. Was sort of the first understanding of PTSD. No one had any idea that these people are also suffering a PTSD. It's not shell shock because they weren't, but it's the same darn thing.
Yeah, definitely. The nightmares they would have experienced. Yeah. I'm sure most of them never stepped foot on a boat again. Like, I wouldn't be able to.
No, I wouldn't have. There's a high rate of suicide following the sinking, unfortunately. And there are a couple of survivors that, you know, wrote that they could never go to a sporting event again, for example, because the cries and the sounds of the crowds was too triggering and reminded them of that night. But yeah, no, you're exactly right, Jeffrey. Like, there was no conversation about mental health at the time. I say this all the time. I'm not the person to write this book because I don't have any training in the medical side of things or the psychological side of things. But I think that a historian should write a book about Titanic and PTSD. There's so many I hate to call them case studies, but unfortunately case studies of what happened to some of these people and families after the fact. And I think it would be a really compelling book to write. I think if someone had like the unique combination of historian and like some mental health professional experience, that would be an amazing study.
That's
fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, for those people sitting in the cold, hoping that they live, knowing that they survived, watching the ship go down, watching thousands of people die.
Losing family members, possibly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes multiple family, like all of the males in your family. Or this is horrible. There's one woman that survived and her two sons did not. I think about something like that as a parent. My brain can't even compute that. And this poor woman had to live that and survive that night. And that's, I can't even imagine.
Wow. So after they made it onto the Carpathia, I'm saying that right? Carpathia?
Mm-hmm. Carpathia, you got it. Yeah.
They did, Jeffrey, make it to the graduation and eventually return to Paris. Elizabeth, I know very little about this, so maybe you can speak a little bit to it. Was Elizabeth asked to testify in the investigation?
Not that I know of. No. There were very few, and this is actually an important thing to mention, there were very few women who were asked to testify.
Well, obviously.
No surprise there.
Yeah, the women couldn't possibly have known what happened, even though they were the ones that were sitting out there in the lifeboats watching it all unfold. So if you have questions about how full were the lifeboats or what did the ship look like as it was going down, they would be the ones mm-hmm. to ask, but they were not.
They couldn't vote. Why could they testify? come on.
Their gentle constitution couldn't have handled testifying, I suppose. But and there are barely any third class passengers that are asked to testify. It's mostly crew and first class men. The British inquiry is a little different. They had a few women that were brought in, like the Countess of Rothes. She's in the movie. I don't think there's any record of her being asked to testify. I mean, I could be wrong, but I've never seen any reference to that. Most women in that scenario after surviving would have, most of them just kind of like they didn't live in New York full time. Mm-hmm. Was sort of like, let's get the hell out of Dodge. It was a lot of just to get to family as quickly as possible and try to get away from the scenario. And if you were someone that had the money to do that, then you were just sort of out of there. Yeah.
So there was the reason I ask is I know that there was that line or she was reported to have overheard Captain Smith talking about the boilers or something. So if you could just expand on that, because I feel like that makes her kind of unique.
Yeah. And that let me see if I can tell. Let me see if I can pull up the source on that. I think it was from a newspaper article. Did you see that? Maybe I'm mixing her up. Did you see that it was in the testimony? I don't think it, or the inquiry. I don't think it was.
I came across like one mention of it, and it might have been geared towards that statement. So like maybe someone had overheard her say that. Wait,
let me see. I'm double checking myself on this because it's been a long time since I've looked at this part of the inquiry. And then I was in the middle of like so confidently answering that because in my brain, these are from newspaper articles. No, you're right. This is from, let's see, is this from the official inquiry? This is from so this is different. So this isn't the US inquiry, but this is from a deposition. And this was taken in 1913. All right. So, I have so confidently answered this question that you had, but now I'm going to stick my foot in my mouth because as we were talking, and as I was going back through some of my research today, a lot of it was handwritten, and I was thinking that all of Elizabeth Lyons' testimony was from newspaper articles, but some real-time, real-life research here has revealed you are right in the sense that it was more a testimony. So her, we have her direct testimony from a deposition that was given, it looks like October 1913, in Paris, because they had returned to Paris at this time. And so it's not the official inquiry, but it is official testimony that she gives in a deposition. And what we know of Elizabeth Lyons' testimony is important. It's actually become quite mythologized, which I think you were sort of referring to. So she's actually in the 97 movie, if you look really closely, because one of the things that was revealed from her recollections of the night is that while she and Mary were on the ship, they would often take coffee in the first class dining room, like in the afternoon. And where they did that was the table right next to Captain Smith and Bruce Ismay, and where they would often take coffee in the afternoon. And so she actively remembers these 2 days where she sort of watched them out of the corner of her eye and listened to their conversation. Captain Smith and then Bruce Ismay, he was the managing director of the White Star Line. Very put upon scapegoaty, mythological passenger of Titanic. He's probably Titanic's ultimate scapegoat. He's always portrayed as very villainous in the films. In the 97 movie, there's a scene where Smith and Ismay are talking. And if you look, there's a woman just out of the focus part of the frame. And she's kind of listening and she's got her teacup lifted with pinky up. And that's apparently, people have talked to James Cameron about it and is supposed to be Elizabeth Lyons. And she's kind of listening in on their conversation. So in this deposition, she does reveal that she overheard the two of them talking about the speed of the ship. Now, I think the myth of it is that in this conversation, Bruce Ismay was like putting pressure on Captain Smith, light more boilers. We have to make it in faster. We have to like beat speed records. But most historians agree that what she overheard was just Bruce Ismay kind of excitedly saying like, yeah, like we're going at a top speed right now. The ship's performing well. I would like to see us push her more. And that Smith was kind of just, nodding along. But Smith would have been, in charge of his ship. He was such a seasoned captain. I feel like there's a chance that that interaction was Captain Smith just sort of being like, sure, great. Yeah, good. Okay, Bruce, And so when people have taken that information and implied that that means that Ismay was like, infiltrating Smith or having this huge influence on how Smith would speed through the night with icebergs, I don't think that's quite what it was. I think probably what she was witnessing was just, the daily meeting that the captain took with him to sort of humor him. And what I know about Bruce Ismay, he was kind of fumbling and babbling and would get overly excited and he was a little awkward socially. So I think it was just Captain Smith kind of nodding along, like, okay, Bruce, sounds good. We'll see what we can do.
Like, we're fine. Yeah, boilers are going, coal's going. Yeah, it's great.
We got it. Do you want to steer the ship, Bruce? do you want to steer the ship?
We can get a picture of you steering the ship.
Yeah, we'll do. There's cameras on board. We'll get you a nice picture, Bruce. But yeah, I mean, that's, and Bruce Ismay has been villainized a lot. I don't think he was a villain. I think he was just kind of an awkward guy that was a little overzealous about some stuff and a little overly excited about some stuff. And he happened to survive. And of course, he's villainized for surviving because he was the managing director. So she, I'd say her sort of claim to fame as a passenger is that she did give this this deposition. I'm so glad we caught that. Look at how confidently I answered your question. No, no women were. I'm glad that I gave it a second thought. You were spot on.
We do it all the time.
Nice when you have multiple people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Catch each. Did you see this? No, I didn't see that. And then so it's like you got it's the buddy system.
You keep each other in check.
I'm very jealous that you guys have co-hosts. If I could go back and redo this, I might have a co-host. I don't know. I'm very jealous of that because sometimes it is just, me and my mic and it gets you know, gets a little lonely. So
that would be nice. A lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work too. So going back to Elizabeth and Mary, and we can kind of start to wrap things up with their lives. Mary went on to marry Sergeant Holbrook Wellman, and they settled in Topsfield, Massachusetts. He was a Massachusetts guy, a lawyer, and as we mentioned at the beginning, she was living a nice, comfy life in Topsfield. I saw she was very involved with, like, the Girl Scouts and a lot of charity work.
Mm-hmm. I saw that.
And then her mother, meanwhile, was traveling the globe. Her husband, Ernest, died in 1936, so she became a widow. And Elizabeth Lyons herself died in 1942. So Elizabeth is the one that we were thinking for a while that she was buried in Harmony Grove Cemetery. She died. So this is, I'm going to give you guys my theory as to why we think, why the information got so jumbled. Because it happens all the time with Salem too. Like certain things, like a story will just get mistold at one point and then it just snowballs and snowballs and snowballs. Jeffrey's favorite word, propagates. Like, and once it gets to a certain
like
point.
The jail and the crushing and Giles Corey.
Yeah, you can't stop it.
It's a good word. It's a good word. I'll give it to you. Yeah.
So her mother, Elizabeth, dies at her daughter's home in Topsfield. At 103 Salem Street. So there's that. She dies on Salem Street. And then I had originally gone into the Salem Evening News archives to try to locate her obituary because I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, it makes sense. She has an obituary in the Salem News. You know, she's buried in Harmony Grove. Like, she's a well-to-do person. Salem was pretty well-to-do at the time. I'm looking at her obituary. It says, the people of Salem send their regards. The service will be held at Grace Church. Grace Church.
Okay.
So
I'm picking up what you're putting down.
So I am in the Salem Library looking at the old, like, microfilm, Salem Evening News. And I see that, yes, she is from she died in Topsfield. Her daughter lives in Topsfield. But I did not find a Grace Church in Topsfield. And I thought it was interesting that the Salem Evening News was publishing the obituary in such a way where it seemed like they were really trying to make, like, a condolence to the family. Like, she was a pretty prominent citizen. And this is Elizabeth we're talking about, not even Mary, who at that point was pretty well known in the community. I'm sure her mother was too. But Grace Church is literally right across the street from the Salem Library where I was sitting. So, like, I don't know. I mean, maybe there was a Grace Church back in 1942 in Topsfield, but I just thought it was interesting that it was referred to as such. I feel like in the Salem Evening News, if they were writing an obituary about this woman and they said the service would be held at Grace Church, they would have said in Topsfield. And I would have probably found a Grace Church in Topsfield. So I would put money on them choosing a Salem church for her funeral. I don't know why, what prompted that, but it makes sense to me. You never know.
Would it make sense to that, you know, if Topsfield is kind of close enough then, and now if she was a pretty prominent person, a very wealthy person. So would it have made sense to, like, have enough room for her funeral to be large, for there to be, like, a prominent announcement in the paper of the larger city? I guess just at first thought that makes sense.
It's not that big of a church.
It's not that big of a church. It's nice.
It's nice. It's in a nice area.
It's in, like, the nicest area of Salem.
Maybe for just status then, possibly.
Maybe, and we may never, maybe they knew someone. They knew the minister. They had a cousin.
That's possible too. Yeah. Or someone just had a connection.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, we were always friends. We can host the funeral. Something Could have been any number of things, but I think.
Or
I think
like you're right. We knew, yeah, maybe they knew the mayor or something. I don't know. I'm just throwing like spaghetti at the wall. But if they were considered prominent in the area, yeah, maybe that's why.
Yeah. So I think that might be why the information got mixed up, because A, she died on Salem Street.
Do we know where she was living?
I don't know.
But she was living, from what I read, she was had moved after the death of the husband father in 36, right? I think he says yep. He said it was 36. I think she was living with Mary. So
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So she was living with her daughter on Salem Street.
Salem Street.
Yeah.
And then I could see just someone at like, and it's Pine Grove Cemetery, Harmony Grove Cemetery. Like
I can
all
see
it takes
getting
is
mixed up. Yeah.
Is one mix up. So.
And her daughter, I mean, her daughter gets married in 1919. And by the way, I just happened to see a photo of Mary's husband. He was super handsome. I was like,
"Oh yeah,
this guy is handsome." And he was I think he was in. No, it was her brother. You know, we should mention her older brother Howard, who was not on Titanic, the one that was graduating from Dartmouth. He sadly died in World War I. He was in the ambulance corps, which I thought was just really heartbreaking. Family went through a lot.
Just a couple years after.
Yeah, in just a matter of a few years. But her, Mary was so if that was 1919, by the time that her mother dies, she's, you know, they've had several kids. She's been, like you mentioned, she was really active in the Girl Scouts. I saw where she was a leader in the Herb Society of America, which is super cool. And she edited a volume about lavender or something. I don't know. I didn't have time to go down a rabbit hole with it, but I thought to myself, that's really cool. So I guess, yeah, you know, if she was a pretty prominent person in the area, then yeah, maybe just it was meant to be kind of a status thing. And then over the course of time, just Harmony Grove becomes, or Pine Grove becomes Harmony Grove because of the connection. But yeah, I think that makes sense.
I just think it's so interesting that it is actually in books that are in print, mm-hmm, like this mix up. Yeah. And of course, it's just going to perpetuate more.
And this is, you know, in many ways, I'm glad that it was, because it's what connected us, because I had a couple of listeners, you know, message me over the last year or so and say, hey, you should do a collab with the Salem podcast, because did you know there's a passenger buried in Salem? And so that's what, you know, brought us together. So I'm glad the mistake was there in some ways. But yeah, it just goes to show you, like we were talking about earlier, you have to go back to the primary sources if you really want to feel that what you're presenting is, you know, 100% your own interpretation, and that you're getting the basics of someone's life right. Because it's so easy to miss those things. I probably would have just always thought that until I got up there one day, maybe looking for it.
And then you'd be like, wait, what?
Where's Pine Grove Cemetery? You're like, well, there's one in Topsfield.
And I would have been, if we hadn't done this, I would have said, where in the hell is Topsfield? Someone help me.
And you would have been in Harmony Grove, like hunting down her headstone.
To be fair, Find a Grave has it right.
Find a Grave does have it right.
It does,
I will say that.
Which, yeah, that's what Sarah and I were messaging about a few days ago. They do have it right, which that was an exciting to see it. I mean, again, most things can be debunked or figured out with a little bit of research. I just think, unfortunately, we live in a society where people don't do it. Like us do, but the average person is not, you know, digging into that kind of thing. So she, her long and, you know, and very full life ends very close to where you guys are. And so does her daughters.
And hey, they may not be buried here, but I would say, based on what we've read and, you know, possibly having her mother have the service in Salem, and just based on how involved in the community Mary was, I would think that they had walked the streets of Salem. Like, I would definitely argue that.
And especially in the in that time period up through the war and just after.
Because Topsfield, even today, it's very rural.
Yeah.
Salem would have been more of like a city center for them. So yeah, I could definitely see them coming inwards for any number of things.
Yeah, or if not here, Boston, he would have passed through here.
They probably went to the Willows and hung out and like listened to music.
Do you think they rode the roller coaster?
Maybe, you never know. Yeah, there's a whole
Mary had kids, so there were kids and grandkids, so probably yeah. So. I mean, they had all the money in the world to work with. They could have, you know, I mean, I'm sure they had plenty of leisure time. So they probably did. And they probably went there to have clothing made and that sort of thing. I imagine they wouldn't have gone all the way to Boston for everything. Probably, you know, to any banking or any things like, yeah, I'm having a dress made. Probably was happening in Salem, right? I would imagine there's a high likelihood.
They probably went to the Daniel Lowe and Company. That was like a fine jewelry. Jewelry and silver and all sorts of things. It was a very high-end department store when it first opened. Oh, yeah. Who knows? They may have had witch spoons. Like, that's where they might.
Who knows? We don't even know. They could have been. Absolutely. I mean, who knows if they were, you know, maybe amateur historians and like dug into Salem's history. I mean, you never know about people. And I want to not forget to mention this. It was very moving. I did see a quote from Mary much later in life. So apparently she started talking a little bit more about Titanic after her mother passed away. But she said she refused to go to the premiere of A Night to Remember, which would have been in 1958. And there were a lot of survivors still alive at that time. So there were quite a few survivors that attended that premiere and a couple that went on set and watched them film it. But she didn't want to go. And then there was a quote from her that she couldn't, what was it? Never, she quote, never understood the fascination with Titanic and why people would want to write about it and make movies about it. And, you know, this is the other side of, I constantly think about this with what I do. There is the very dark and dismal and bloody and horrible part of Titanic, which is a big part of it, the sinking. You know, we romanticize it so much, but I see her point. I mean, I get why she would be confused that people want to romanticize it, think about it if they didn't need to. Like for her, it was this traumatic thing that she probably wished she could block from her mind. It affected probably the rest of her life. And so that's the other side of it. You know, it's interesting and important to point out that side of it too, is that these trauma events that become these things we study in history and we become obsessed with, and we have artifacts and books and we collect things. The other side of that is that for someone who went through it, it's horrible and they probably never wanted it mentioned again. And it's easy to forget that sometimes.
And again, making our podcast so similar in that way, you know, we focus very much so on the Salem Witch Trials. It's a big portion of what we talk about. It was devastating for over 100 families, for generations in some cases. And it is tragic. And yet we still have 1.2 million visitors come visit us in October. So it's like that morbid fascination, the curiosity, the longing to learn about dark history. I don't know if it's something to do with putting a mirror up to our own mortality and having this close relationship to death. I mean, this guy next to me has multiple skulls in his collection. So I don't know. It's just no matter what happens, no matter what kind of tragedy happens, not to bring up like recent events, but when the Explorer thing,
when they were going down to
see the Titanic,
the Titan. Yeah.
When that happened, like the whole world stopped and watched. And like, I mean, it was just pure, and people wanted to know how exactly they would have died. And like people were watching simulations on it. So no matter whether it's 1912 or 2024 or 1692, we somehow as humans just end up like being drawn to this type of story.
I think for me at the end of the day, it's the one thing that you can never experience.
Ooh, that's good. Mm-hmm. You can't experience death.
I think sometimes it's the obsession with wondering what you would have done too. I know for Titanic, yeah. that is a big part of it for people, you know, the constantly kind of chewing and chewing over and talking about, you know, if I was in this situation. And so I think the Witch Trials probably do that for people to, you know, it is a mirror. And then it's also a chance to explore our own ethics, our own morality, think about what we would have done in a situation, be grateful that we weren't in it. You know, there's an adrenaline that comes from studying things that were horrific that luckily we were not a part of and we can peek in on.
But yeah, it's like putting yourself in that survival situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think what you guys do and what I do is really not that different. We were talking about it before we recorded. I think we both do podcasts about, I mean, yours is so fun because it's a place too. I am very jealous that you get to do, you know, some of the, you know, modern history and things going on now. That's so fun and makes me want to visit more. But yeah, I mean, it's really what we're studying is people's fascination with this one era, with a particular era or event in history, and why in pop culture, it just comes back again and again and again, and what's behind that. So I think we probably are having pretty similar experiences to that end.
And hopefully this won't be the last time we collaborate.
I know. Well, I next time you guys do a live show and there's like enough of a heads up, maybe then that's when we should come up and do like a vacation and come to your show or something. But I definitely want to bring the kids up to Salem. I know that they would love it. So we'll get up there at some point and we'll have to take each of your tours and we'd love to have you. And we can do, and then we could do like a record something and do like a recap. But no, this has been so much fun.
Follow up.
We'll do a follow up. Yeah, I'll grade your tours. No, I'm just kidding. I'll do.
Well,
I do love having PhDs on tour. Makes me just a little nervous.
That's not my area where I've ever like officially academically studied. So no, you guys are the experts, which is, you know, it's another reason why your podcast is so good, because I probably don't have to tell you this. There's so many podcasts, even history podcasts, where people are starting doing research. They're just like throwing up what is on Wikipedia. And, you know, you guys are steeped and trained in what you're doing and academic about it. And that's the quality that shines through. That's why it's good. And the only way to do that is to actually sit there and do the research, and it comes through. And so you guys do an amazing job. It's so good. I recommend your podcast to like 5 people a week. It's always like dinner party conversation.
Now I'm going to start crying.
Because I am that person that will be at a dinner. And if, you know, history comes up in any way, I might say, do you know about Roanoke, or do you know about Salem, or do you know? I am that person that just like throws crazy things out across the dinner table, and I love to talk about things people are obsessed with, and I love like the minute that history is mentioned in any way. Obviously, I'm, you know, the annoying person in the room, but yeah, I have recommended your podcast a lot, and I'm very excited to make it up there one day, so we can meet in person. It'll be so fun.
Well, speaking of Salem, we do have 2 last questions for you that we love to ask.
I forgot.
All of our guests. You're not getting out of these ones.
I would have forgot.
Oh gosh, no. These are my favorite questions to ask everyone because they're always so different. You've been to Salem quite a bit. You spent some time up here. What is your favorite thing about this city?
Well, my favorite thing is not necessarily a specific place, but it's a feeling. And I remember walking down, I wish I could remember what street it is, but I remember walking down a street and seeing one of the folding board signs for a tarot reader. Mm-hmm. So my friend and former roommate Brian he's the opposite of anybody that would want his tarot read. I mean, maybe it's a rebellion because he's from Salem, so he hates all of the witch stuff, just all of it.
Understandable.
And anything mystic or paranormal, anything. Very practical person. And so I, you know, I'm standing there in the middle of the street kind of hemming and hawing, like, please stop and let me do this. So I did. But I just, but that was like, when I think about spending time in Salem, that's my favorite memory, is just that feeling when you walk down the street there that sort of anything's possible, because everybody is so steeped in all of this mythology. And it was so fun to just stop and kind of give into that for a moment and like have my terror. Anyway, so
it's like magic. That's like real magic.
It's it is magic. It is really magic.
It's a magic feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like no other. And that's why you get so many visitors every year. It's why people go back and go back, because it is it's just a magical place. And when you step foot there, and it's just a feeling. I don't have to tell you guys that, you know, but when I roll back to my time there, I can channel a very specific feeling. And I don't think I can do that with like every vacation I've ever taken. You know, it's only certain places that have that.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. And it's definitely distinct in the town. It's weird. It's like this. No one does it. There's no like, no one in charge of like.
Like it's not Disney.
Yeah, yeah. It's not planned.
It's not manufactured necessarily.
It's just like such a community and such a space that there is just.
It happens organically.
Yeah.
Makes Salem very special.
Yeah, it's awesome. That's a really good point. It's like, you guys have that without it being manufactured by a corporate entity. It's this world that's created by everybody in the community just agreeing and doing it together. I never thought about it that way. That's super cool.
And the visitors too. Because like I feel like so much of what our city has become is because of the people that come to it. Not just the folks that are keeping the lights on and the wheels turning, but the visitors dictate so much of what we have to accommodate. So, you know, it's an interesting relationship.
Parking and sidewalk.
Yeah. All right, Jeffrey, hit her with the last question.
Okay. Last and definitely not least, of course, you know, hope you have your answer prepared. Who is your...
Oh, I do. She's like, you don't even have to ask the question. But wait, do it, because I don't want to take... You ask it. I want to be formally asked.
It's like on Jeopardy when they go to ask the question. They just dig in with the answer. Who is your favorite witch or wizard?
It's Samantha from Bewitched. I know that's... Listen, I know that's it could be viewed as a stock answer, but for me, it is not. If I couldn't say anything else and not be true to myself, because I grew up watching Nick at Night all of the old shows on Nick at Night in the 90s. And my dad, so I was born very late to my parents. My parents were like slightly older parents, especially back in the 80s and 90s. When I mean, now everybody's kind of older parents and that's like how it is. But they were so into showing me stuff from their childhood. And my dad is like this amazing amateur historian of Hollywood and knows everything back to like 1920. But I would just sit and watch black and white shows, old shows, and Bewitched was my favorite. And Samantha was my favorite. And I can't tell you, I probably watched every single one of those episodes at least 10 to 15 times over the course of my childhood. So I couldn't say anything else and not be true to myself. I couldn't give a cool answer. I had to give.
No, I think you might be the first person to ever say Samantha on this podcast.
I wasn't going to say that because I wanted to. We don't have a list, but
I don't think anyone has ever said Samantha. Yeah. So you are unique.
Oh, okay, I'll take it. I'll take it. I thought that would be, you know, I mean, you guys do mention her because of the statue and stuff. So I probably just thought that she'd been said before as an answer to this. But I'll take being the first. That's awesome. Yeah. I love it.
One of my favorite things, little fun facts I learned from another tour guide in town. She was a young child when they came to Salem to film a couple episodes here for the Salem Saga. And Elizabeth Montgomery, along with the rest of the cast and crew, were staying at the Hawthorne Hotel. And this tour guide, shout out to Beth, she would stand on the corner of Essex and Hawthorne Boulevard, because every night Elizabeth Montgomery would come out to the window, open it, and wave to anyone in Salem that wanted to see her. Every
that's
night.
So cute. Oh my gosh.
So sweet.
See, and that's like, that's the kind of research I love too, like oral history interviews, or like that's why podcasts are so important, because interviews are sources too. And that's how you find out about little anecdotes like that.
Stand
oh my
by.
Gosh. Now I just want to, I wish I was coming to Salem like next week. I want to come so badly soon. I need to get a good trip planned so the kids can experience everything. But this has been so much fun. Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Thank you, LA, for joining us. We'll have all your links to the pod, the Unsinkable podcast, in the show notes. Check out her content.
Thank you for your crash course in Titanic history.
We did get a little bit of one in. Yeah. And, you know, and you are right. Like, you know, even if someone's not necessarily like a total Titanic head, there's a lot of other stuff. I do side series, and there's a lot of like fun sort of thematic episodes. I do like the beer on Titanic or like food stuff.
Ooh,
and
fine.
That kind of thing. But yeah, and I'm looking forward to sharing it on my feed as well, because I think a lot of my listeners will be really excited to find your podcast if they haven't already. Like I told you, I think the Venn diagram is probably really huge for interest in both. And so I'm excited for more of my listeners to discover you guys as well.
Yeah, who would have thought? But I am so pleased that we got to do this.
Thanks for a small historical typo that led us down this road.
I know. Thank goodness. The many groves of the Salem area cemeteries, but
Harmony, Pine, whatever. Here we are.
Yeah, here we are.
All right. Well, thank you so much, LA and Jeffrey.
Thanks for listening.
See you later.